From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with David Balsiger, director of the new film George W. Bush, Faith in the White House. Its marketing literature describes the film as offering an insider's look at how the president's dependence upon God gave him the exact clarity of vision and quiet confidence needed to lead us through terrorist attacks and the ensuing wars with Afghanistan and Iraq. The film is being marketed as an alternative to Fahrenheit 9/11, directed by Michael Moore, who we spoke with yesterday. We'll also talk with the head of the presidential prayer team, whose goal is to encourage Americans to pray for the president and to pray for the election. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. The head of CARE International's Iraq operations was kidnapped today. Margaret Hassan, a British-born Iraqi national who's married to an Iraqi, was taken from her car by a group of men. Later in the day, an Arab TV station showed video of her in captivity. Also in Iraq today, multiple mortar shells hit a military base used to train the Iraqi National Guard. Four people were reported killed and about 80 wounded. NPR's Emily Harris has this report.
Most of the wounded were evacuated by U.S. military helicopters and taken to two American field hospitals. A National Guardsman with a bandaged leg and bruised face leaving an Iraqi hospital after treatment told NPR the base was hit several times with 82-millimeter shells. He couldn't say more before an Iraqi military intelligence officer whisked him away. Iraqi National Guard and police are frequently attacked by insurgents. Despite that, U.S. officials involved in training say there's no shortage of people willing to sign up. The number of trained or partly trained forces killed is rising, though. This weekend, nine policemen, fresh from training in Jordan, were shot to death in their minibus while traveling home. Emily Harris, NPR News, Baghdad.
A federal judge ruled today that Michigan must count provisional ballots that are cast locally, even if voters are in the wrong precinct. The ruling conflicts with several others in recent weeks on how provisional ballots should be counted. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
States are required to offer provisional ballots to those voters whose names can't be found on the registration list on Election Day. The ballots are then supposed to be set aside and counted later if the voter's registration can be verified. But the law is unclear whether provisional ballots should count if they're cast in the wrong precinct. Michigan's Secretary of State said they should not, but U.S. District Judge David Lawson ruled that they should be counted if cast in the right city or town. On Monday, Florida's Supreme Court ruled that provisional ballots in that state should only be counted if cast in the correct precinct. Last week, a federal judge in Ohio ordered that such ballots there be counted if cast anywhere in the correct county. The issue could prove crucial if the vote in the presidential race on November 2nd is extremely close. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry has sharply criticized President Bush over his handling of the flu vaccine shortage. In an interview with NPR, Kerry cast the shortages of flu vaccine as a sign of presidential mismanagement. In Pennsylvania today, Kerry also castigated the president over the economy and his handling of the war on terrorism. In Florida, Mr. Bush accused Kerry of propelling his campaign with complaints and scare tactics. The president said he will keep the promise of Social Security for seniors and that the country will not have a draft. The Dow Industrials closed down 58 points today at 98.97. The Nasdaq was down 13 at 19.23. This is NPR News. One of the world's most prestigious literary awards, the Man Booker Prize, was announced today in London. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
This year's Man Booker Prize, honoring the best novel of the year by a citizen of the British Commonwealth and the Republic of Ireland, goes to British writer Alan Hollinghurst for his novel The Line of Beauty. The story of an innocent young man who gets caught up in a circle of wealthy and powerful friends during the 1980s, the novel has been described as a masterpiece. The winner of the Man Booker Award takes home £50,000 and an almost guaranteed upsurge in book sales. The 2002 winner, Life of Pi by Jan Martel, went to the top of bestseller lists, and Oscar-winning films such as The English Patient and Schindler's List have also been based on Man Booker Prize winners. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Social Security recipients will get a 2.7% cost of living increase in benefits starting in January, but today's announcement follows one 6 weeks ago that Medicare premiums will rise by more than 17%. Therefore, a typical Social Security recipient will receive an additional $25 per month, but half of that amount will be spent on higher Medicare premiums for new prescription drug coverage. The Boston Red Sox are trailing 3-2 against the New York Yankees, having kept their hopes alive in extra innings last night. Tonight, it's Game 6 of the best-of-7 American League playoff in New York. In the National League, the Houston Astros have a 3-2 lead over the St. Louis Cardinals, and they're scheduled to face off again tomorrow afternoon in St. Louis. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Buffalo Niagara Enterprise, point of contact for business expansion in tourism, logistics, customer service, and manufacturing in Western New York. BuffaloNiagara.org.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Weird U.S., your travel guide to America's local legends and best-kept secrets, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Sundance Channel, presenting the new political satire Tanner on Tanner, starring Cynthia Nixon, from series creators Robert Altman and Gary Trudeau, tonight at 9. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of A Wizard of Earthsea by Ursula K. Le Guin, the basis for this December's Sci-Fi Channel miniseries.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, we talked with Michael Moore about his controversial documentary, Fahrenheit 9/11. My guest today, David Balsiger, directed a film that is being marketed as an alternative to Fahrenheit 9/11. It's called George W. Bush, Faith in the White House. The film features a series of interviews and reenactments focusing on the president's faith and how it's affected his personal life and his decisions in the White House. The press release says, "See how his religious beliefs bring personal peace and clarity in a time of terrorism and chaos across the world." Frank Rich, in his Sunday New York Times column, wrote about the film, "In this pious but not humble worldview, faith, or at least a certain brand of it, counts more than competence." The film was shown at the Republican Convention's Family, Faith, and Freedom Rally, as well as on Christian TV networks. It's also out on DVD. Its production company, Grizzly Adams, specializes in what it describes as family-friendly feature films. Many of its productions are Bible-related. The company is named after its series, The Life and Times of Grizzly Adams. David Balsiger is the company's vice president. Let's start with a clip from the opening of his film, George W. Bush, Faith in the White House.
It has been stated by some journalists and historians that George W. Bush has brought about the most faith-based administration in American history. This program will attempt to determine whether or not that statement is true, and if it is, what effect has his faith had on America and on the world?
That's the opening of George W. Bush, Faith in the White House. David Balsiger, welcome to Fresh Air. So do you feel like your film reaches a conclusion about whether George W. Bush is leading the most faith-based administration in American history?
Well, I think that's absolutely true, at least the most faith-based since the time of Abraham Lincoln. We see it in all parts of it, his administration. We see it in his personal life. We see it behind the scenes. It's absolutely the most faith-based administration in contemporary times.
And do you feel like your film reaches a conclusion about what effect that faith has had on America and the world?
Well, I think it has had an effect in several different ways. For other religious believers in America, they feel comfortable at night. They sleep well knowing that this president prays, reads scriptures, and consults about 20 different spiritual advisors, from evangelicals to Protestant mainstream, Catholic, and even a Jewish rabbi. When it comes to government and diplomats and people I've interviewed for the show indicated that they like to know where a man is coming from. They like to know that he's the same today and he'll be the same tomorrow. He's the same in private and he's the same in public. And because of Bush's faith, it seems like he's that kind of a man compared to other contemporary presidents that sometimes have been one way in private, another way in public, and a third way on their opinions based on opinion polls.
Now, your film quotes a reporter from the BBC named Justin Webb as saying, "Nobody spends more time on his knees than George W. Bush. The Bush administration hums to the sound of prayer. Prayer meetings take place day and night. It's not uncommon to see White House functionaries hurrying down corridors carrying Bibles." Do you agree with that perception? Is that what you've seen, too, or what others have told you they've seen?
Well, that seems to be very true. Not only is that a clear perception of what happens, but we even go beyond that in our show. We've discovered, for instance, that people have walked in on the president in the Oval Office thinking he was there, and he was down on his knees praying. We know for a fact that he has prayed with numerous world leaders. He has shared his testimony, his faith, how it has meant so much in his own life with some of his addictions and other problems, and how he relies on faith and sometimes making the big decisions that aren't easy to make.
One of the things the president's faith-based administration has led to is the creation of a presidential prayer team. You interview, I don't know if you did the interview, but the person who heads that team is interviewed in your film. How did that team start? What does it do?
Well, that particular team started after 9/11. They were intending to start and pray for our military and all presidents, not specifically just Mr. Bush. But it started back after 9/11, and it has about 3 million people praying for the president, different world leaders, different domestic leaders on a daily basis. And the president is probably the most significant president we've ever had when it comes to his belief in prayer and intercessory prayer, meaning other people praying for him. He's constantly thanking people who pray for him, and that organization, of course, is one of the biggest that's doing it on a daily basis.
Let's hear another excerpt of the movie. In this part, James Robeson, who's a religious broadcaster and a friend of President Bush's, is describing a conversation he had with George W. Bush about his ambivalence early on about running for the White House and then his conviction that he should.
And he said, you know, God really did change my life. And he said, you know, I never wanted anything to do with politics. I always wanted to, just be the fellow, even if as governor now, which he said surprises me that I made this decision, but I'm glad I did. But he said, I want to be remembered as the man who walked in Walmart to buy fishing lures and used to be the governor. My dad was president. That's the only way I want people to think about me. But he said, I honestly believe that I am supposed to run for president. He said, I believe it's something God wants me to do. And he said, I can't explain it, but I believe my country is going to need me at this time.
On September 11th, 2001, that premonition came true. The nation and the world changed.
That's an excerpt of George W. Bush, Faith in the White House. And at this point in the movie, we see the collapsing World Trade Center towers. My guest, David Balsiger, is the director of the film. David Balsiger, what do you think is the connection between George W. Bush's premonition and September 11th, the premonition that God wanted him to run for president?
Well, with a lot of Christians, they believe they have a calling on their life. Some believe they're called to be a missionary, a social worker, even a preacher or a minister. And George Bush had this kind of a calling premonition prior to running for president. He had been in a church service where they were talking about Moses, and he had the strangest calling overcome him, and he started sharing that with some other pastors, and they said that's not unusual and that you should, in fact, run for president if that's the calling you feel the God is speaking to you about. So it may seem extraordinary to non-believers, but it seems pretty normal to believers because these kind of things happen.
If people feel that the president is divinely chosen, then does that mean the president shouldn't be challenged because he was chosen by God for these troubled times?
Well, I don't know that we're saying the president was necessarily divinely chosen, but he's probably the man for the hour at the time of that terrorist attack. And most people, including whether they were Democrats, Republicans, or non-voters, I think felt very comfortable with how the president led the country. Should he be reelected because of that? Not necessarily. People have to make their decision based on whatever the issues are most important to them. In the religious community, particularly among evangelicals, faith is probably the biggest issue in how he stands on certain family moral issues. Other people look at different issues.
The film seems to consider the possibility that God wanted George W. Bush to be president, especially during these troubled times after September 11th. If the president loses the election, do you think that that would be God's will?
Well, you know, God's will is usually God's will. If he loses the election, it would be God's will. If he wins the election, it would be God's will.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Balsiger. He's the director of the new movie, George W. Bush, Faith in the White House. How did you decide to do this film?
Well, we have a rather unique approach to the shows that we do for commercial television. We take concept ideas for a show, and we test them on the Gallup poll, and those that score extremely high, we pitch those to networks, and we put those in production. And George W. Bush, we started testing about 2 years ago, and there was a strong interest in whether or not Bush walked the talk of his faith, because we saw it on the surface, but what was he like behind the scenes? The concept scored high, and fortunate for us, three books were published at the end of this year, beginning of this year, that we obtained the rights to. Then a second fortunate thing, I think, for us was the release of Fahrenheit 911, which gave us a chance to position our show as a positive alternative to that show, looking at another side of Bush that people were interested in but seldom seen because it's an unauthorized documentary. We did not contact the Bush administration, the campaign, or the White House, but we wanted to look at what other people who had a faith-based experience with Bush could actually tell us what the man was like when it came to talking the walk and walking the walk.
When you do that Gallup poll testing before actually, you know, producing the movie, do you test just to a Christian audience or do you test to a broader audience? Is it kind of like niche testing? Because I think many of your broadcasts are on Christian networks.
Well, actually, no. We're actually secular television producers. In the last 6 years, we've produced 400 shows. 85 of them were biblical in nature. The others ranged the gamut from who killed Princess Diana to why TWA crashed. And so we test a broad audience to determine what the public at large would like to see. Fortunately or unfortunately, depending how people look at it, a number of biblical-related topics came up. And some of our shows have pulled the highest ratings in 5 years on some of the networks. So we're been family-friendly television producers for 31 years, and this is one more show in that series of those kind of documentaries that we do, but it's had a larger audience, it's had more play, it's become controversial, and it's opened up some new markets for us that we haven't had before.
Your film was shown in Dallas at the Renaissance Film Festival, which was a film festival for conservative filmmakers. It's been described as a patriotic alternative to the Sundance and Cannes film festivals, described by its creators that way. And several, I think at least two movies in answer to Michael Moore's movie were shown there in addition to your movie. Were you there? Can you describe what the atmosphere was like?
Yes, we've actually been asked to have our film in probably a half a dozen or more film festivals, something we've not done in the past. But I was there. I did watch the entire festival, and our film was probably the most positive one as an alternative to Michael Moore. A number of the others went directly at Michael Moore. I felt that the quality of some of those were no better than Michael Moore's. Michael spent $6 million on his. We spent $250,000. Ours is light years better in production quality. Ours is also balanced. We have 18 proponents telling about the president's faith. We have 10 critics that have criticized the president's faith. Michael Moore has neither critics or anyone giving an opposing viewpoint to what he has to say.
I will mention, though, that the critics who you represent in your film are not interviewed. You just read quotes from them.
That's correct. Many of them did not want to appear, and we've done other shows where critics sometimes do not want to appear in a show. So the best we could do is take their statements that they boldly made, and we had hoped they would come on screen and make those same statements, but we were declined.
Now, your movie was also shown at the Republican convention. Can you describe the setting for that screening?
Well, what we were doing there is, as in any film, we look for the various legs that we can promote through. For instance, we just did a film called The Search for Heaven, and a big market for us there is selling it into funeral homes and things like that. So when the Republican convention came along, we saw it as a venue not only to get some media exposure, but to preview it once a day for delegates and others that were interested in it. And we've done that at a number of other conventions too, family-friendly conventions and any venue that we think will help get broader sales for the product. And we're even out there in the mass market. We released our DVD with a major distributor the same day that Michael Moore released his on October 5. Michael Moore is in number one position on the new list, and we're at about 17 or so on the out of all overall. I think we're 23 out of 9,000 DVDs. So we're right up there in the mainstream of what the public wants to see, as our original Gallup poll testing told us this topic would generate in the marketplace.
My guest is David Balsiger, director of the documentary George W. Bush, Faith in the White House. It's being marketed as an alternative to Michael Moore's film Fahrenheit 9/11. We heard from Moore yesterday on Fresh Air. We'll hear more from Balsiger after a break. This is Fresh Air. Election Day is coming, November 2nd. But today is a voting day for public radio. The way to vote for public radio's future is by calling with a pledge. Supporting your station is the best way of ensuring that it will continue to be there for you to listen to. If you've come to rely on NPR's in-depth news and interviews, I urge you to back that up with a pledge. Thank you. My guest is David Balsiger. He produced and directed the new documentary, George W. Bush, Faith in the White House, about how faith has affected the president's personal life and political decisions. Your film raises the question of separation of church and state. Where do you feel your film, how do you feel your film finally interprets that and, you know, where that line should be?
Well, we all talk about separation of church and state, that it's in the First Amendment. In reality, it is not in the First Amendment, and Senator Zell Miller is on our show and clearly explains that. If you have a church and state dilemma, it would probably be in the area if federal funding was used to actually advocate a particular faith or to bring people into a faith or, say, to purchase Bibles, for example.
You also quote or paraphrase William Rehnquist, Supreme Court Justice, Chief Supreme Court Justice, as having said that the country was not founded on the principle of separation of church and state.
Well, that's true. It was basically founded on the principle that the state should not endorse any particular religion, such as in England, for example. They endorse one particular state church. And that's really the issue it's speaking to. It's saying, well, the United States government does not endorse Roman Catholics or evangelicals or Baptists. They're all welcome, and the state will not give one favoritism over another.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Balsiger, and he's the director of the new film, George W. Bush, Faith in the White House. I understand that this movie is being marketed largely to a Christian audience and that it's largely a film directed to a Christian audience. But what do you think people who aren't Christian or who don't subscribe to the same interpretation of Christianity that George W. Bush does, what reaction do you think that they would have upon seeing this movie? A movie which, their faith might tell them very different things than President Bush's faith does. it might interpret things very differently than President Bush's faith does.
Well, I don't think it has a negative really in any marketplace. A lot of Christians are buying it presently, but you know, originally we designed this to have bigger sales in the secular marketplace, and that's where the huge sales will come. But let me give you an example. In Kuwait, they're anxious to air this show, and we ask them why. Well, they said, we love President Bush over here. We even name our kids after him, and we know he has a strong faith, and we want to know what makes him tick.
Have you seen Michael Moore's movie, Fahrenheit 9/11?
Yes, I have.
And your reactions to it?
Well, I thought Michael Moore, for spending $6 million, and we spent $250,000, and you'll see light years difference between the production quality. A lot of his movie, for instance, was just shot off of a television screen. It was poorly edited. The production values of his film would never be suitable to meet the standards and practices of a major secular network. It's important what you put on the screen as far as quality and content. You also have to have balance to get on television. For spending $6 million, maybe it was all paid in the producer-director fee to Michael Moore, and only $500 was put on screen. And looking at that, being a filmmaker, documentary producer for 30 years, we could have made that show for between $300,000 and $500,000. So where the rest of the money was spent, I don't know. It did not go on screen.
You've probably read the article that Frank Rich wrote a few weeks ago in the New York Times. This was one of his Sunday New York Times columns, and it focused on your movie, George W. Bush, Faith in the White House. And Rich wrote, more than any other campaign artifact, it clarifies the hard-knuckles rationale of the president's vote-for-me-or-face-Armageddon re-election message. It transforms the president that the Democrats deride as a fortunate son of privilege into a prodigal son with the moral clarity of an old-fashioned biblical prophet. What's your reaction to that?
Well, you know, I've done something like 300 interviews prior to the Frank Rich column, and we had release on that column 5 days before it was published, and I said the minute I saw that column, it was such a vicious attack piece that this will be the best thing that ever happened to us. And his column did have a line in there. It says, this is a must-see documentary. And then he went on, and a lot of his comments were inflammatory, and his own opinion had nothing to do with the film. But let me tell you what it did for us. It gave us a whole new level of interviews that we had not had before. We also had difficulty getting our show into Walmart. They had turned us down 3 times. After the Frank Rich column, they ordered 40,000, as did a couple other chains. And all of a sudden, it brought brand new international as well as domestic attention to our show. So if a piece is extremely bad, sometimes it's extremely good.
David Balsiger directed the documentary George W. Bush, Faith in the White House. It's being marketed as an alternative to Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11. We heard from Moore yesterday. Balsiger will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with David Balsiger, director of the documentary George W. Bush, Faith in the White House. And we hear from John Lind, head of the Presidential Prayer Team, which encourages Americans to pray daily for the president and to pray for the upcoming elections.
Thank you.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Sundance Channel, presenting the new political satire Tanner on Tanner, starring Cynthia Nixon, from series creators Robert Altman and Gary Trudeau, tonight at 9, and from Nonsuch Records, featuring A Ghost Is Born, the new album by Chicago band Wilco, on tour across the U.S., available at all Barnes & Noble music locations.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David Balsiger, director of the new film George W. Bush, Faith in the White House. It's being marketed as an alternative to Fahrenheit 9/11, whose director Michael Moore was our guest yesterday. Balsiger is vice president of the Grizzly Adams Production Company, which produced Faith in the White House. The company specializes in what it describes as family-friendly films and programs. Many of its productions are Bible-related, including Ancient Secrets of the Bible, In Search of Heaven, and In Search of Noah's Ark. Now, since you do a lot of Christian programs, I'm wondering, like, if you could compare some of the differences between how Christian movies are released and distributed, and how you get to your target audience for that compared to more secular programs.
We have to keep in mind we're commercial television producers, and the big problem these days with television, you can never get a large enough license fee to cover your budget for your production. So any network only pays you about a third of what your cost will be in producing a show. So you always have to have other venues and avenues of recovering your money and making a profit to continue on in business. So what we look at many times is what opportunities exist for any show that we're doing. If the Gallup poll says this is a very important topic that would have strong viewer interest, we still have to say, well, does it have good retail interest in DVD? Does it have possible crossover into the religious market? Does it have good foreign licensing, and is it evergreen in some way? For instance, Fahrenheit 9/11 will be dead after the election. We believe this Bush special will be evergreen for 10, 15, or 20 years, as they show many documentaries on Franklin Roosevelt and World War II. So we look at all those kind of things in doing a show.
Now, you mentioned that one of your new movies, The Evidence for Heaven, is being shown at funeral homes, that's one of the markets for it. In your own advertising, The Evidence for Heaven is described as, see evidence that heaven is more real than earth. What's the context of how it's being screened in funeral homes?
Well, you brought up an interesting topic here. Generally, on any show that we make, we have anywhere from 5 to 7 versions to accommodate all the different venues of how the show will be used or marketed or broadcasted. And in the case of Heaven, Evidence for Heaven is the religious version. It's a longer version that goes into more of spiritual aspects of heaven. The Search for Heaven is the secular broadcast version, which is more universal, mentions heaven in other faiths too. And in the way it's used in funeral homes and that, they're just simply given to people who have lost a loved one so they can view that and feel more comfortable with the afterlife, or if they're believers, that heaven exists. And heaven does exist in all major religions, by the way.
Do you see yourself, do you see your production company as an alternative to Hollywood?
Oh, absolutely. We do everything opposite of how Hollywood does it. We do it backward, as some people tell us. Typically, Hollywood starts with a script, and they promote and find somebody that will pick it up, and they find producers, directors, funders. They finally get it out, whether it's a movie or a TV show, and they finally get it out, and they hope everybody wants to see it. Well, we do it all backwards. We determine to begin with, right up front, does anyone want to see the show that we're thinking about, or the 100 concepts that we test every quarter? In reality, my partner has often said, we've never done a show that we ever wanted to do. We've always produced shows that people wanted to know more about, or topics or subjects that were of interest to them and not our own pet projects.
Would you like your new movie, George W. Bush, Faith in the White House, to have an effect on the election?
Well, you know, several people in our company, including myself, were faith-based believers, and generally we make our decision on any candidate, whether it's a president or another person, do they have a faith? Do they rely on their faith at all? Or do they consult pastors, ministers, rabbis, and those kind of folks in making the big decisions? So I think we would hope that the show would have some impact, but it can equally have a negative impact with people too. But we're told by a number of Christians who buy 500 or 1,000 units at a time that they're distributing them to pastors and others. And what we're also told is that it solidifies fence sitters, because in the Christian realm, if a Christian isn't sure who to vote for and they're using a faith factor, they don't vote at all. And so apparently this show is solidifying some of those folks. Some have told us it has neutralized Bush bashers. But the most important thing, I think, about this show that will be known even long after this election, it's a highly inspirational show. Many people, men and women, tell us after seeing this show or during parts of this show, they're shedding tears, and it's so inspirational. It aspires them to do better in their own Christian walk, to become more caring and compassionate in their own lives. It actually had that effect on me.
Well, David Balsiger, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
David Balsiger produced and directed the new film George W. Bush, Faith in the White House, which is being marketed as an alternative to Fahrenheit 9/11, whose director Michael Moore we heard from yesterday. Coming up, the head of the Presidential Prayer Team, which encourages Americans to pray daily for the president. This is Fresh Air. One of the interviewees in the film we just discussed about the faith of President Bush is on the staff of the Presidential Prayer Team. My guest, John Lind, is the head of the team. Its website describes the team as an independent nonprofit organization which has a singular purpose: to encourage Americans to pray daily for the president. As part of its project, Pray the Vote, the Presidential Prayer Team also urges members to include prayers for the upcoming elections. The team was created just a few days after the September 11th attacks. It has a staff of 9. According to Lind, about 3 million people have participated in the group's activities. Its funding comes from members, email campaigns, and appeals. Lind has been president and CEO of the team since 2002. John Lind, welcome to Fresh Air. What does the Presidential Prayer Team do? What is its mission?
Basically, its mission is to encourage, motivate, and challenge people of faith all over the country to pray daily for the president, our nation, and our armed forces.
And what is the president's role in the prayer team? White House role?
There is no role. We are totally independent, non-denominational, non-sectarian, non-political. Our call is simply to pray daily for the president and our nation and our armed forces.
Now, members get updated listings of the president's prayer needs. What are some examples of the president's prayer needs that you've emailed your members about?
Well, it depends on the week, because what we try to do is we try to get information from public domain of different schedule, maybe of the president or maybe who he might be visiting, or different trips he's making abroad. And some of the things also we're praying for is specific people. In his cabinet, maybe on a director level on up. Like, for example, this week we're praying for Don Rumsfeld. We're praying for the new director of Central Intelligence Agency, Peter Goss, Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge, and the FBI Chief Bob Mueller. So these are just some of the things that we're trying to do in order to not only pray for our president every day, but also other aspects of our country.
Now, your website says your church can influence the highest people in government through one simple act, prayer. What influence do you think prayer can have on the highest people in government?
Well, I think it helps give them wisdom. I mean, these are our leaders of our country that are making critical decisions that basically affect all of us. And we're not issue-oriented, but we're prayer-oriented. And so a lot of times we focus on the specific person that God would give them wisdom in the decisions they make on our behalf.
In explaining what to pray for, you say pray for American leaders' protection, clarity of thought, godly wisdom, and for them to follow God and His Word. What does it mean for our leaders to follow God? Which God? Whose view of religion?
Well, we come from the point of view, Terry, that we're biblically based. So we're talking about the God of the Bible. And so our approach is simply that we're praying to the Lord, the God of the Bible, in order to be able to give them wisdom in not only the decisions they're making, but also give them, like you said, clarity of thought, because, you know, we're in a world that's very, in some cases, in a serious world of hurt and pain across the world. We're in a war. These are all issues that our leaders are making decisions on our behalf on a daily basis. And that's kind of why I believe we're calling people to pray daily, not just whenever they feel like it, but to make a commitment to pray daily for our leaders.
When you say the God of the Bible, do you mean Christian?
Well, part of our focus and our foundation is biblical truth and our scripture that we kind of build our organization on is found in 1 Timothy chapter 2, where it talks about that we urge people to, first of all, with that request, prayers, and intercession and thanksgiving be made for everyone, for kings and all those in authority, that we may live peaceful and quiet lives. That's our mission. That's our foundation, our biblical foundation. And most of the people on our list are from the Christian background and persuasion.
There's a press release that you have about praying for the elections.
Yes.
And this was issued I think, in the spring. And our interest is not to ask God to get any one candidate elected. Rather, our goal is simply to open a window for God to work through the election.
Right.
What does that mean for God to work through the election?
Well, I think if you see kind of what's been happening over the course of several months in the presidential election, how, in a sense, disunifying it could be to our country. And I think part of what prayer does is unify people. And I think that is part of opening the window for God to work, is to help unify in our country that whoever's elected, that we can rally behind that individual and work to pray for that person on a daily basis.
Do you believe that God has a choice for president?
I think we have the choice for president. And I think God uses us as an instrument to help put that individual into office.
So do you think the voters are doing God's will?
I think so, yes.
So that means that President Bush was willed by God to be president?
At that particular time in 2000, yes.
And if he's voted out of office, what would that say about God's will?
That it's John Kerry's turn.
I'm wondering if you read, there was an article in the Sunday New York Times Magazine this weekend by Ron Suskind called about Bush faith and certainty. And it was an article about the president's faith and the implications of that for his presidency and for his foreign policy and so on. This article quotes Bruce Bartlett, a domestic policy advisor to Reagan. He was a Treasury official for the first President Bush. And he describes the president as having, quote, a sort of weird messianic idea of what he thinks God has told him to do. He truly believes he's on a mission from God. How would you react to that?
Well, I mean, I think, it's how I think how the president maybe might define, or this person define, what the mission from God is. To some, that seems kind of mystical. But I think a lot of times when people are motivated by prayer, motivated by Scripture, motivated by their religious persuasion, I mean, that could be a call of God as well. And so I don't really feel that it is, you know, more or less of a strength or weakness of the president. I just think it's kind of how he's built.
One more quote from Bruce Bartlett. Absolute faith like this overwhelms a need for analysis. The whole thing about faith is to believe things for which there is no empirical evidence, but you can't run the world on faith. What would you say to that?
Well, I think you have. I personally, I think you need to have faith to run the world. We're living in a precarious times around the world, and I wouldn't call myself an expert, but just I kind of think that having faith in God is an important aspect of getting the kind of wisdom needed in order to get this analysis to be able to make decisions that will affect not only us in America, but people all over the world.
What is your understanding of the separation of church and state? And do you feel that this presidential prayer team, in asking God to work in our nation as never before, and in asking people to pray for the president, and in asking people to pray for the president during the election, do you feel that that crosses the boundary at all, or do you feel that it does not?
Oh, I don't think it does at all. And I think it's even more of a an added benefit for our country. But I don't think that at all. I think the separation church and state was to keep the state out of the church, not the church out of the state, originally. And so I think it's very important to encourage more and more people of faith to pray on a daily basis. And I think if we can be able to help change the culture of prayer in America, that will manifest itself through this this unity that we talked about earlier, I think it would do wonders for our country.
Getting back to the election a second, if you have, as part of your Pray the Vote campaign, as part of your election campaign, if you really believe in the power of prayer and you have people praying for the president and not asking people to pray specifically for his opponent, John Kerry, aren't you asking people through their prayer to tip the balance?
Well, if John Kerry was the president, then we would ask people to pray for John Kerry, who would be the president. But he's not at this particular time. So, like, I go back to my original point, is that we are the presidential prayer team. And so we still want to continue to pray daily for our president, who is still making decisions on our behalf. But if John Kerry becomes president, starting, in, of course, in January, right after the inauguration, we're going to pray daily for him.
Are there certain policies that you think go along with God working more actively in our nation?
Such as what?
Abortion, for instance, banning abortion.
Well, I think the issues, you know, we don't really deal with issues. We deal with people. And the things that we're trying to put on our website on a regular basis or refresh every week are more people-oriented. Now, obviously, there's issues that they're having to deal with, and that's why they need prayer, because they're having to make decisions on things like abortion or euthanasia or terminally ill people, health insurance for the poor, et cetera, et cetera. There's a myriad of issues, but what we try to focus on, of course, is just the people that are helping to make those decisions on our behalf.
One last question. If we accept the premise that you stated that President Bush was God's choice for the White House, does that mean that we should be more confident about accepting any decision that the president makes because God approved that choice? He was God's choice to be in the White House.
Yeah, but he's still someone that can make mistakes. And I don't think everybody is going to agree with every decision he makes. But that's the way our country is set up. And so, but if John Kerry wins on November 2nd, we're going to obviously align ourselves with praying daily for John Kerry. And he'll make decisions just like any past president has made, and people are going to agree with some of the decisions he's going to make and some that he might not make.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
You bet, Terry. Thank you very much.
John Lind is the head of the Presidential Prayer Team, which encourages Americans to pray for the president. This is Fresh Air. On Fresh Air, we bring you interviews about popular culture, politics, and religion, and the places where they intersect. We know our listeners have diverse political views, but we hope you're united in wanting to preserve public radio and maintain a place in broadcast radio for in-depth news and interviews. The way to ensure public radio's future is to call with a pledge. Thank you. Two new food books have whetted book critic Maureen Corrigan's appetite for a good read. Nigel Slater's memoir, Toast, was first published last year in Britain, where it won the British Book Award's Biography of the Year. It's just been published in the United States. And Frances Osborne's Lilla's Feast is a biography of the extraordinary life of her great-grandmother, spiced with some dashes of fiction. Here's Maureen's review.
You are what you've eaten. That's the basic ingredient of all food memoirs. They maintain that the Mapo, SpaghettiOs, and Yoo-hoo you ingested as a child have by now been assimilated into the very fiber of your being. Many foodie autobiographers recall those formative days of cheesy glop and sugary goo with delight. But celebrated British food columnist and cookbook author Nigel Slater sneers at what he calls the chocolate chip cookie memoir route. At the outset of his memoir, Toast, Slater warns that he's going to look back in indigestion at his middle-class boyhood of the 1960s. By his own account, Slater's youth was nothing to lick one's lips over. His mother died of asthma when Slater was small, and his erratically tempered father was capable of flying into head-slapping rages at the sight of a juice stain on the carpet. But anti-sentimentality is not Toast's most distinguishing feature. After all, lots of food memoirs, like Ruth Reichel's and MFK Fisher's, have served up the bread of bitterness along with the dessert course. Rather, Toast's brilliance as a memoir derives from Slater's nastily funny renderings of the act of eating itself, as well as the revelation he dramatizes throughout his book that nothing is so intimately and potentially shamefully revealing of people as their appetite and what they shove into their mouths to satisfy it. In addition to the British national propensity for caustic wit, Slater is also graced with a gift for recalling and describing smells. This is an odorific autobiography that should come accompanied by a scratch and sniff pad, but only for the intrepid. Describing childhood Christmases, Slater says, "Forget scented candles and freshly brewed coffee. Every home should smell of baking Christmas cake. It was a pity we had Auntie Fanny living with us. Her incontinence could take the edge off the smell of a chicken curry, let alone a baking cake. No matter how many mince pies were being made, or pine logs burning in the grate, or how many orange and clove pomanders my mother had made, there was always the faintest whiff of Auntie Fanny." All too soon after his mother's death, Slater's father falls head over heels for an ace cooking and cleaning lady named Mrs. Potter. Slater recalls that, even doused with topaz, the perfume she bought from her daughter's Avon catalog, there was the undernote of pledge to her. Life takes on a Dickensian turn when Mrs. Potter becomes Slater's stepmother, his father dies, and Mrs. Potter wins the inheritance jackpot. Slater is rudely pushed out of his lonely adolescence to make his way through London cookery schools, where he encounters horrors that rival the great gagging moments of Anthony Bourdain's best-selling tell-all, Kitchen Confidential. But grotesquely memorable as those moments are, the most compelling parts of Slater's memoir lie in childhood, where despite his resolution to be unsentimental, his writing is leavened with a yearning for the lost mother who couldn't even make toast without burning it. Lilla's Feast by Frances Osborne also serves up the food memoir axiom, "You are what you've eaten," and then kicks it up another notch. Osborne's book is what would be classified these days as creative nonfiction. It's a biography of her great-grandmother, born Lilla Jennings in 1882 in the British trading port of Shefu in northern China. Throughout her narrative, Osborne also describes the detective work she engaged in to ferret out details of Lilla's life, and she explicitly fictionalizes when facts aren't available. The impetus for all this investigation and conjecture is a little recipe book Lilla wrote that's now displayed in the Imperial War Museum in London. For 3 years during World War II, Lilla, like other European and American nationals, was held prisoner in a Japanese internment camp in China. Suffering under barbaric living conditions, she wrote down old recipes on scraps of paper. Those step-by-step directions for making treacle scones and oxfoot soup helped Lilla reassemble and hold on to her sense of self. In contrast to Slater's chop-and-dice wit, Lilla's Feast reads slowly, like a minor Victorian novel that takes its own sweet time to gather its multi-layered flavor. Relying on a trove of family letters, Osborne focuses in on Lilla's troubled first marriage to a British Army officer. She reconstructs the dread, no-exit dependency of a middle-class woman of that time on her husband. Lilla cooked her way out of that first marital jam, just as her later dreams about cooking helped sustain her during her years as a prisoner of war. Like toast, Lilla's Feast transports readers back to a world that is no more, and finds that the quickest route there is through the stomach.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Toast by Nigel Slater and Lilla's Feast by Frances Osborne. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Yesterday, a child came out to wonder.
On the next Fresh Air, Joni Mitchell talks about her life and music. She has two new CD collections. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fearful when the sky was full of.